Women's Talk, which features as one of the 43 events taking place here in the Marquee. I am delighted to introduce our next speaker, Danny Dorland. Danny will be discussing the topic, Demography of Inequality, focusing on bringing together his last two publications, Why Demography Matters and the Equality Effect. Danny Dorling is a social geographer and the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford. His work concerns issues of housing, health, employment, education and poverty. Danny has written extensively about the widening gap between rich and poor, and his work regularly appears in the media. He is the author of a range of books, including The No-Nonsense Guide to Equality, The Atlas of the Real World, Unequal Health, Inequality in the 1%, and Injustice, Why Social Inequalities Persist. I've handed out handouts that goes with this talk, so for those of you who haven't got them, I'll try and whiz one round to you. I presume it's going to be the people standing that have joined since I've got them round to the chairs, so I will run that round to you. I hope you find this topical discussion very insightful and ask you to please join me in welcoming Danny Dorling. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. Can you hear me at the back?
Yes.
Great. I decided I wanted to talk about these two books because these are two issues that people don't often put together. People don't often connect equality and inequality with demography. Demography being births, marriages, deaths, fertility rates, migration, these kind of things. They think of that as a very technical subject and equality as a very political subject. But the two are quite closely related. We can talk about migration, I think, mainly later on in questions. I'm sure people will have some views about migration, but the relationship between economic inequality and migration is that countries which have very wide economic inequalities, like the United States, tend to bring in a lot of migrants because there are a lot of jobs at the bottom. We bring in a lot of migrants. We often complain about the fact that a lot of migrants come, but they come because of the kind of economic structure that we have, and then when we make different political decisions, it changes. So this year we've already seen a big drop in people coming, which is something, of course, that we haven't seen, because you can't see a big drop in people not arriving. But I won't say anything more about migration. Fertility is remarkably closely linked to equality. There's a whole section in the Equality Effect book about the relationship between how many children people have on average and how affluent their country is. The more affluent a country gets, the fewer children you tend to have, but also how equitable it is. And if you happen to live in both an equitable and affluent country, you're looking at about between 1.3 and 1.7 children per couple. It's about the fastest way in which you can get fertility down is to be well off and to be equal. And again, we could talk later about what the reasons for this might be. It has a lot to do with the power of women, and women are much more powerful in countries which are more economically equal, because one of the things that economic equality tells you is you're not paying a set of women much, much less than a set of men. You can't be an economically equal country and manage to do that. We're very unequal, so we have one of the highest fertility rates in Europe, not quite two children per couple, but near to it. The United States is even more unequal, so it has a fertility rate that's even higher. And if you want to get quite complicated about this, one of the fastest ways to reduce fertility in the world, and already over half the world is below fertility replacement, less than about 2.05 children now per couple, one of the fastest ways to reduce fertility in the world is to help people migrate from poor countries to rich countries. Because when people migrate from a poor country to a rich country, they tend to have fewer children than they would have had they stayed in the poor country. So the more migration you get in that direction, the fewer human beings you actually get on the planet as a whole. And I'm gonna leave that one with you as well. There's just so many connections between these things. What I want to talk about is mortality and death. Not because I'm a particularly morbid person, but because it's topical this week in particular. And the letter I've handed around is a letter from my colleague Martin McKee to Sarah Williston, who's the chair of the House of Commons Select Committee. And it's just an example of the kind of letter you could write to Sarah if you wanted to suggest that maybe Sarah could do something about what's currently happening in this country to do with mortality and how that connects or possibly connects to inequality. Now the story starts, the current story starts around about 2012. Around 2012 we began to notice that the life expectancy of elderly women, this is women aged around about 85, wasn't going up at the rate it had been going up in recent years. In fact, it actually went down by 5 weeks. And that kind of thing doesn't tend to happen. Life expectancy in all rich countries in the world, and even faster in poor countries, tends to go up by about a year every 4 years, a year every 5 years. There was a point, I think it's about 10 years ago, where life expectancy in Kensington and Chelsea was going up by more than a year. And the interesting thing then was that you knew it wasn't going to last, because Kensington and Chelsea would have had to become Mount Olympus, if you see what I mean, if life expectancy goes up more than a year. And it was to do with the splitting apart. Anyway, 2012, life expectancy of elderly women across the United Kingdom drops by about 5 weeks. Very small but noticeable. 2013, we begin to get the first evidence that this may be connected with a halving of the number of visits of adult social workers to elderly people. The cuts meant that there were half as many of those kind of 15-minute visits. You knock on the door, you take your coat off, you make a cup of tea, you say hello, how are you? You put your coat back on and you go and you drive to the next elderly person. Those visits were absolutely decimated again and again and again. Decimation is 10% of. Meals on Wheels. Meals on Wheels were cut by about a similar amount. You might think, oh, it doesn't matter. What's the importance of somebody turning up with a hot meal when you haven't seen anybody all day? So we did an experiment to see if you like what it does matter, and we cut Meals on Wheels. Rural bus services. And again, this is the kind of thing you wouldn't immediately connect. But supposing you've done really well in life and you've managed to get that little cottage in the middle of rural Oxfordshire, and then they cut the one bus service a day and you can't drive anymore. The interesting thing about elderly women is they're much more likely to be living on their own as opposed to elderly men, because elderly men tend to live 5 years less than elderly women and tend, for this generation, to have married a woman who on average would have been about 5 years younger than them when they married. So it's a fairly sure bet if you're a man of this generation, you're not going to be the last one on your own. And that's the kind of guess about what happened. That was 2013. 2014, the mortality had carried on not improving. And not just for elderly women, it wasn't getting better for elderly men now as well. But it wasn't that bad in 2014, you could have said, you know, this looks like a little blip, we're not quite sure what's happening in the country. I happen to think that some of the frailest people died in 2012 and 2013, and then, you know, you had some fitter people who'd managed to get through those years, were around and so on. And so it was very debatable. There were articles written in academic journals about it, also linking cuts to pensioner credits to the rise in deaths, linking cuts to people who were disabled to rises in death, an extra, I think, 4, 5 or 6 suicides for every one of those, for every 10,000 of those interviews about are you able to get benefits. The saddest statistics are people on benefits because they're ill. At the peak, 40% when surveyed saying that they've considered suicide in the last few years. So we're beginning to get clues of things going on, and it's not good. But 2014 was bad, but not too bad. There was a debate. 2015, tens of thousands of additional people died in January and February and March 2015. The worst winter we had seen for decades. Wasn't a particularly cold winter. There wasn't a flu epidemic. We actually had one of those in 2010, but it didn't kill many people, because people don't die of flu nowadays. But 2015 was very, very bad. There's possibly one year in the 1960s that might have been as bad as 2015, but that might have been the year where you had to bring your relatives in, or they weren't going to be allowed into Britain because we were changing the rules on who was a British citizen. And so people got their very elderly relatives in time. 1944 was worse, for a year that got worse. 1944 was a very bad year. After that, you're really going back to 1865, 1895, 1911 flu, for years in which you saw things getting worse in the same way they got worse in 2015. The official response of government, it's the flu. It's influenza. This is always the responses of governments who are not that interested. Macmillan, who was housing minister, when the smog came in London in the 1950s and many thousands of people died, said, oh, it's the flu. It took some years for it to become clear. Luckily, a study of the flu was going on in London at the time, so we're absolutely sure that that wasn't the flu. The flu is very convenient. That was 2015. People began to get a little bit angrier. The academics who are writing about this didn't get on quite as well with the government officials who they're supposed to be working with about this. The government officials who had written letters, public letters in 2013, saying, oh, don't worry, it's a cold winter, it's chance this kind of thing happens, stopped writing any public letters. None of the four chief medical officers of the United Kingdom said anything. No chief executive of the National Health, no chief nurse, no chief knowledge officer, no senior official in the Department of Health and Social Services. Nobody has said an official word since 2015 about this. Life expectancy, according to the European Union in the United Kingdom, has basically hardly risen from 2010 to 2015. In every other country in Europe, the increase in life expectancy has been larger than in the United Kingdom. In Finland and Norway, they've gained over a year. Nothing's happened. Nothing bad's happened. This is not a continental-wide thing. Germany had a bad year in 2015. Just 2015. Germany also had to let in 1 million people from Syria, who weren't in particularly, you know, a good state. 2016 carries on being bad. Unusually high rates of mortality, kind of increased acrimony between the people involved in monitoring this. All the monitoring is kind of done quietly. Nobody actually has a responsibility to monitor. Lots of people have a responsibility to produce statistics. Nobody has a responsibility to look at them. It's quite remarkable. Nobody is charged with the responsibility to actually say when they think something very bad is happening. That's partly how you can get into the kind of mess we're in. The other thing, I suppose, happening 2015 and 2016 is the government's official opposition was otherwise engaged. Let's put it like that. So in normal times, this kind of thing would have been highlighted by the government in waiting, saying, and by then we knew this was the slowest improvement in health this country had seen since 1891. The 1880s were very bad, if you want to go back there, but we won't do that, where the word unemployment first came from. But since 1891, we had not seen a slowdown like this. And it wasn't due to smoking. It wasn't because people started smoking in greater numbers 30 years ago. The rate of smoking had been going down and down. And they've gone down remarkably since the smoking ban came in public places. It's not due to drinking. Particularly since the recession, the amount of which people are drinking, particularly the people who've been most affected, has fallen. We now have the highest proportion of the population who don't drink alcohol since we first recorded that. It's not due to obesity rising. That'll come. You know, don't feel happy if you're looking a bit like me. But the generations who are most affected, they never got obese in the first place, right? They were too old for that group. It wasn't due to bad behaviour that this has actually occurred in Britain. And it's not just the elderly. By By 2016, the first paper was published in the British Medical Journal, which said that for working class infants, that is babies born to parents who had a manual job, infant mortality had risen significantly since 2010. That doesn't happen. The last time infant mortality rose significantly was the long, hot, sticky summer of 1905. That's the last time we saw that, but that's for everybody. This is working class infants in the British Medical Journal. And then, as you can see, I can go on and on about this, but I'm not going to bring it to hold. And I'm embedded in this, in that I've been writing about this since 2013, and I've got increasingly annoyed because it's become apparent that it really doesn't matter how bad things get. Nobody's going to say anything about it. By 2016, our neonatal mortality rate, that is babies dying in the first few days of life, was the 19th worst in Europe. In 1990, it had been the 7th worst, 19th worst. We're still doing better than Romania. Now, there's a few other countries, but essentially, 19th worst by 2016. And then, let's bring it forward. 2 weeks ago, the Office of National Statistics produced a report that said that the poorest fifth of women in Britain, all of them, life expectancy is falling. The Times newspaper a month ago began to list the areas of the country in which life expectancy is falling. Last year, pension providers for private pensions, that's the better off among us, you don't get a private pension unless you're pretty well paid, said that they didn't have, and I think it's £315 billion in liabilities was no longer a liability because they didn't expect to be paying the private pensions out as long. Not based on any of this data, based on the data from the pensions' own companies, because they know when their own members start dying earlier. So even better off people, life expectancy has not increased as much as it was. The Office of National Statistics, just before December, revised the population projections for the entire country. Before, we had what was called the 2014 base projections on data then. They then produced the 2016 base projections just before December 2017 and took away 1 million years of life from what they expect all of us to live. It's an average year of life lost by 2040. Still going up, but going up by a year slower than before. That's because of the number of people who've died. And then, most recently, in the first 7 weeks of this year, an additional 10,000 people died above the number who you'd normally expect to die, given the rates of death in the last 5 years, which have been a very bad 5 years. 10,000 additional deaths is a 12% rise in just 7 weeks. Seven relatively warm weeks. The average temperature was half a degree above the norm for that time of year. The cold snap didn't come in until week 8, week 9, and week 10. 7 weeks in which the proportion of people dying from any respiratory illness was hardly any higher than normal. Hence, it's not influenza, it's not pneumonia, because the Office of National Statistics now record that cause of death and publish it weekly with a 2 week lag. So we know it's not flu, we know it's not the cold, we know it's not smoking, we know it's not alcohol, we know it's not obesity, we know it's not people behaving badly. We know it's not that the over 70s have suddenly got into drugs in a big way. Right? There is a small increase of overdoses of people about my age. It is a few hundred. This is 10,000 deaths in 7 weeks. These, of course, were the 7 weeks in which the National Health Service announced that it would cancel up to 50,000 routine operations. It actually cancelled just over 20,000 in the event. Unprecedented. That should have helped. The cancelling of tens of thousands of routine operations meant that places like the John Radcliffe had beds available for people when they don't normally. I haven't talked about the fact that you can't get people out of hospitals and all of that, and that the cuts in adult social care are far worse than the not increasing spending on NHS the way we should. By the way, do you remember the bus going around saying 350 million a week? The amount it should have said is 1 billion. If we wanted to have the same quality healthcare that they get in Germany, they spend an extra £1 billion a week on health in Germany. And they do that while still paying more than we do into the European Union. But that's, if you really want a good health service, you need to spend an extra billion a week. Forget that 4 billion for the 2% pay rise a year. Remember, inflation is 2.7, by the way, 2.7%, so a 2% pay rise. If any of you can tell me, by the way, why the BBC thinks we're so stupid that they can say this is a pay rise when inflation's at 2.7, I don't know. Let me bring you up to date, then. Up to Tuesday of this week. So we will get up to date. We've been trying, the reason for giving you this letter, that you could, if you like, write your own version and send it to the chair of the Health Select Committee. We've been trying to just get some response. When the 10,000 deaths number was revealed, which was on Friday in the British Medical Journal, I was contacted, because I was one of the two authors of the editorial, I was contacted by the press officers of NHS England, because the BMJ had put a subtitle which says something like, health chiefs fail to investigate. And NHS England wanted to know, what did we mean by health chiefs? Not, isn't this a terrible thing that this is happening? They wanted to know, what did we mean by health chiefs? We eventually responded, we mean by health chiefs anybody with the word chief in their job title or something senior. You know, you've got a kind of responsibility. On Tuesday, a Member of Parliament asked a question in the House of Commons, and luckily Tuesday was one of the very rare days when Jeremy Hunt has to answer questions. Jeremy Hunt, for those who don't know, is our wonderfully gifted Secretary of State for Health and Social Care. I say gifted because he's managed to hold on to that job for a very long time, and we can speculate about why and how. The next time Jeremy Hunt will be answering any questions will be the 2nd of May, because Parliament rises for Easter. So if you want to write to your MP and say, could you ask a question of Jeremy Hunt, get it in before the 2nd of May. So Dr. Paul Williams, MP, asked the Secretary of State for Health directly, why did these extra deaths occur? And for the first time ever, on Tuesday this week, we got an answer from the Secretary of State for Health. And he says, as the honorary gentleman will know, these figures cover England and Wales. He will also know that they do not take account of changes in population or changes in demography. So we use the age standardised mortality rate, which according to Public Health England has remained broadly stable over recent years. End of statement. That's it. So let me try, I've got less than 5 minutes, to explain what he meant. Because of course he didn't think of that answer, somebody wrote it for him. The first part of his very short answer, these figures cover England and Wales. He's not responsible for Wales. And if we can't produce figures that are just for England, he's not going to answer us. That's what that says. You can produce figures just for England. 9,701 extra deaths. And it hopefully should be published by now in the British Medical Journal this afternoon. But he could work it out for himself. He's a public bloody figure. It's unbelievable. But he thinks you are too stupid or unconcerned to care. He must do. Otherwise, why not give a fuller answer? By the way, I have a very bad relationship with the Department of Health and Social Care. A paper that we published in the Journal of Royal Society of Medicine last year, they called something like a triumph of bias over truth or something. The Department of Health and Social Care employed 22 press officers. They're all listed. You can look them up. You can write them an email and ask them what they think they're doing. What is their job? What are they there for? The Department of Health and Social Care recently, at least, rather than issuing their standard reply on this, which is cancer rates have never been lower, we're spending more on health services than ever before, and fewer people are smoking, which for some reason you need 22 press officers to release. At least in the last 2 weeks they've begun to write, it's a bit complex and we welcome additional research. Right, but this is very, very slow. So his first answer was, it's England and Wales, so he doesn't have to say. Does not take account of population changes or changes in demography. I suspect he means age structure by that. I contacted the Office of National Statistics a few weeks ago to ask them, did they have any evidence of small boats arriving, slightly Dunkirk style, off the coast of Devon and Cornwall, offloading frail elderly people who haven't been recorded at Heathrow or anywhere else, from Spain, who've arrived to die in large numbers recently? And my contacts in the Office of National Statistics very kindly said no, they had no evidence that this has suddenly occurred. Age standardised mortality rates have remained stable in recent years. The last part of Jeremy Hunt's amazingly brief statement. This is data which is now 2 years old, and yes, they have been stable. For the first time since 1891, because before 2010, they've been getting better almost all the time. So stable is very, very bad. But it's possible that Jeremy doesn't know that. It's possible he really doesn't. I honestly don't know. I can't tell. I do think he would like a very different kind of health service. I do suspect that he thinks that a state-provided system is terrible, and it sets a terrible example, because if you have a collectively provided health service, well, you could have collectively provided schools and collectively provided housing, you know, and that kind of thing, and that would be bad. So it would be quite good if people came to think of the health service as something that wasn't that good, and it would be better if we kind of broke it up and had entrepreneurs running it. I suspect, I'm very strongly of the opinion that Jeremy thinks that. What I don't know is, how many people is he willing to see die early to get it? That's what I would like to know. How much longer does this have to carry on? Week 10 of this year, data released yesterday, 2,000 more people died than in the same week in the last 5 years. Now that was a very cold week, but still 2,000 dying over the odds. By the way, this isn't because of aging. Aging is people living longer. If we start to die faster and in greater numbers, we will no longer be aging. It isn't because we've had a sudden big cohort of old people. The last big cohort of old people were born in 1946 and 47, 9 months after the troops came home. And they are currently in their 70s. Before then, you were born either in the war, which was rare, or in the 30s, where we actually had a very, very low fertility rate. In fact, we had a fertility rate so low in the 1930s that the government then worried about the population going down so fast that the country would be empty by the year 2000. So this terrible thing is happening at a time when we have unusually few elderly people. If we can't cope with our elderly population now, what happens when that 1946 baby boom generation are heading to their 80s? What happens when a little baby boom I'm in? I'm a 1960s baby that's the children of the 46 babies. What happens in my old age? There's a lot more that's worse to come. And why is it happening in Britain and nowhere else in Europe? Well, which country became the most economically unequal in all of Europe? Occasionally Estonia beats us, occasionally Latvia beats us, but generally we managed to win that global race. It's us, and you don't become the most economically unequal country by accident. and you don't run down your health service to become the lowest funded per capita. Greece spends more per head on health than we do. So hopefully, that's my half an hour, hopefully I've shown you why I'm bothered about equality and demography. And I didn't have the foresight to write a book with my friend Stuart Gittel-Baston called Why Demography Matters, simply for the pleasure of sending it to Jeremy Hunt to explain to him that when he says about demography in his statement, he might want to know what the word actually means. These things are intimately connected. What kind of future we're going to have, what kind of future our children are going to have, who's going to come here, where we're going to go, is all related to the kind of economy and society that we've chosen or put up with having. And whether people who don't like the way things are and would like us to be more divided and think inequality is great because it rewards the clever people with the special genes, whether they get away with that partly depends on the extent to which people understand what is actually going on and the fact that it isn't just an unfortunate thing that's happened by chance. And that cannot be said strongly enough. And finally, I think you are getting to the point where you do have to start saying who's responsible. Because it's taken me a number of years to realise the only time I get a response is when I actually say, you might have a responsibility for this. Government statistics are always released a day or two early to a list of people. And that list is published on the web. And that list includes the Secretary of State for Health, the Principal Secretary to the Secretary of State of Health, the Chief whatever, the whatever. It's quite long. And I think it's worth saying that if your name is on the list of people who are so important that you have to get a statistic early, then you bear some responsibility for what those statistics show about what is happening in Britain. Finally, as far as we can work out, the only group who could investigate this quickly, who could call the chief medical officers and put them in front of a camera and ask them what their view is on this, all four of them, who could call the Secretary of State for Health, who could call the Chief Executive of the NHS, who could call any witnesses they want, is the House of Commons Select Committee on Health. Now, Sarah is a Conservative MP. This is hardly a kind of radical committee, but nothing like this has happened to health of the people of Britain since 1944 now. We've way overtaken that 1 year in the 1960s we're not sure about. So when you have the worst event in health that you've had since the war, maybe the Select Committee could ask about it. And finally, I almost forget these now, on Friday, completely coincidentally, Office of National Statistics released the news that it wasn't just working class infants now who were dying faster. Overall, infant mortality for all babies in the United Kingdom has risen significantly last year and the year before. 2 years in a row. Never happened since the war. So instead of being 19th in Europe, we're now heading to 21st, 22nd, 23rd, and we're getting nearer and nearer to Romania. And at some point, Romania is actually going to overtake us in the same way that Slovenia and Croatia and Portugal and all the places we thought didn't know how to look after babies have already done. The tragedy of this is the Radcliffe, actually not up there, the old Radcliffe when it was over there, in the 1950s put in some of the first baby incubators in Europe, and we had in the UK one of the lowest rates of infant mortality in the world, and in Oxfordshire we had one of the lowest rates of infant mortality in the whole of the UK, and that was just the 1950s. And to go from that to this is absolutely appalling. Thank you very much for your attention. Please think of a question. The man at the back with a hat. Shout out. People are not equal apart from identical twins. Although, the interesting thing is even identical twins behave a little bit differently. You're right, we do have differences between us. They're not huge, but there are differences, and some people are healthier than others. In that 2015 event, where there's extra deaths, there was only one age group where mortality didn't rise, and that was people aged 25 to 29 in Britain. Now that group is also the group with the highest in-migration from Europe. Migrants from Europe in their 20s tend to be remarkably fit. They're not genetically, migrants aren't genetically the same as other people on average. So one of the things we're beginning to discover is that one reason why life expectancy has only actually begun to fall now is it was being held up by healthy young people from Europe coming with all their healthiness, and at the same time we were exporting our old people. Nick Clegg's dad, David Cameron's dad, they both died in France. They don't count in the statistics of Britain. Another question. So I've had no questions from women. The one over there. Shout out because I'm deaf. And the industry paying a bit. Yes. Yeah. How did Germany manage to spend so much more? Switzerland spends the most. Switzerland spends twice as much per head as opposed to what we do. And they worry about it, but it's... apart from Ireland, every other large country in Europe taxes people more. France, Finland, over 50% of GDP is taken in tax. We are heading for only 35% of our GDP to be taken in tax. So we simply don't raise the money to pay for services. We are the stingy country in Europe when it comes to that. On top of that, Germany also makes other decisions. You know, we decide to spend quite a lot of money on, is it four or five rusty old submarines? Right? Germany isn't bothering to fund four or five rusty old submarines. There are other choices of things you can do. Not taking part in wars with America saves you a lot of money. Labour overspent by 2% of GDP when it was in power. Now it's just the cost of the Iraq war. If you don't do that, it gives you money to spend on your health service.
No. There's no effect of political opposition.
Yes.
Are there any journalists?
Okay. If there's no effect of political opposition, are there any journalists? The fascinating thing is that the BBC is not touching it. I have contacted you, Pim, this week, just to say, can I be of any help? I've noticed it's been a year since you've said anything. The BBC is in a very tricky situation. Simon Red Lewis, who's an economist based in Oxford, wrote a blog where he said it's one thing the BBC reporting economists saying we're going to be £4,000 worse off. Who believes economists? That's fine. The BBC reporting that more people are dying and we're ruling out all the possibilities other than austerity and the cuts. It's very hard if you're supposed to be a politically neutral broadcaster to report that news, and Simon explained it. The story that came out on Friday was covered in Times, Telegraph, Mail sympathetically. A year ago the Mail covered it unsympathetically. The Mirror, The Independent, every newspaper apart from The Sun. So journalists will cover it, but the BBC won't yet. But they will at some point, because this is just the absolute numbers of deaths. I mean, this is, and it's the first 7 weeks of this year. Those numbers feed in to other statistics. In 2 years' time, they'll come out in the life expectancy numbers. So the statistics are going to get worse and worse, I can tell you now, for the next 2 years. So at some point it'll be reported, but you know, no doubt we'll blame it on Brussels. You know, I'm sure it'll be that they're really intransigent negotiation that's made people in Britain so angry about sovereignty, you know, that we are not living as long because of social effects of, I don't know. They'll come up with something. They will. Yes.
What about the problem that when the TV reports something, they like to have a person, personal story, whereas this, it's very hard to find one person who's died younger than they should have done.
It's hard to turn it in. There isn't a Jennifer's Ear thing here. Mm. If you're my age old, you remember Jennifer and her ear and the parents who didn't agree with the story. It's a choice. So the story's about the numbers of people who die because of air pollution. I mean, some of us are going to die early because of the quality of the air in Oxford. Nobody's ever going to know which ones where it is. But that's still reported because it's seen as science and not political. And so the BBC science correspondent will report that. We can report the numbers of people each week, additional people who've died. In some weeks it's 1 in 5. In terms of elderly people it's 1 in 4. So we can tell you the week, we can tell you the days, we can tell you the number. We don't know which one on that trolley that ended up right at the back. If any of you have been to the John Radcliffe, early on the Monday morning is the worst. Early on the Monday morning is when relatives who've been keeping their elderly relative alive over the weekend finally give up and drive in because they're hardly managing to breathe anymore. And the trolleys go all the way back through triage, all the way to the front of the John Radcliffe. Now you can't say which one of the people on those trolleys who dies today would have died anyway or wouldn't have died if we had been a society that had better looked after ourselves, or if they had just been born 5 years earlier and this had happened to them 5 years ago when things were better. But you can begin to report these things. Some journalists have taken stories of individuals who've died in their 40s or 50s and been very badly served to try to tell the story, but it's not easy. The way I would tell it is us. Of the extra million years of life that ONS say will be lost, the majority of them are people aged between 40 and 60. And I'm guessing quite a large number of you are aged between 40 and 60. So it's us. We're the ones who won't be getting the extra years of life if this continues, and that's now in the official statistics. So I would tell the story based on the Office of National Statistics official statistics, saying the average person in Britain now can expect a year less. That means some dying quite a few years earlier. That means less time with your grandchildren, less time collecting that pension, more years in poor health beforehand. And then when you are ill, being cared for really, really badly by somebody on one of the lowest wages in Western Europe because of the kind of country we live in, and then looked after by nurses and doctors who can't afford the rent on the house in Oxford that they have to live in. And, you know, selfishly, forget you lot, that's my future. You know, it doesn't. I could be completely unemotive and have no kind of feeling for the rest of you at all. I know that Bupa's not going to look after somebody, you know. Bupa isn't actually great at this kind of stuff. You know, get something serious and they send you out to the National Health Service. Just for me, and maybe my family, it would make sense to have a better system and to spread things out more. The NHS is worth about £4,000 a year to each of us. It's a £4,000 you really don't want to use. Right, the great thing about it is it's not something you go, oh, I'm not getting my £4,000 worth of NHS care this year. You get smashed up on the ring road and you'll quickly get £250,000 worth of care. Right? That's the idea of a collective system. It's something you want to be there, but you desperately don't want to have to call on. And even individually, even if you don't care about anybody else, it makes a lot of sense to have this. I grew up in this city, and I can remember the 1980s when there were just, I think it was 7 ITU beds on the new Radcliffe on the hill, 7 intensive therapy unit beds. And those seven intensive therapy unit beds were routinely full with people who were very near to death. It's where you go after intensive care. And I remember thinking, if the Prime Minister is travelling through Oxfordshire today, Margaret Thatcher, and she's in a major car crash, and that last ITU bed is full, she cannot get ITU care. And then I can remember working out, and they know that. And they've calculated it's not worth paying. We'd rather pay less tax in the 80s and take the risk than fund a health service that would actually even look after the Prime Minister. There are no private ITU intensive care beds. There isn't any accidents and emergency in private hospitals in Britain. Now, as a teenager in the 80s, I remember working this thing out and thinking, you really are into survival of the fittest. You know, why? And that was part of the mentality of 1980s Conservatives. And part of what I think we see now with people like Jeremy Hunt is, as teenagers, they bought into this. Don't waste too much money on caring for everybody. Times are tough, there's a global race going on. Why are people like me worrying about 85-year-old women dying 5 weeks earlier? What good is an 85-year-old woman for the productivity of Britain on the global race? Nobody's yet said what they said about unemployment, which is a price worth paying. But part of what has to be going on is that there are people in power who don't think that neonatal mortality going from 3.0 to 3.2 babies per thousand is much of a problem, because you're only talking of an extra 0.2 babies per thousand. It's very sad for the couple involved, but look at the money we spend, save, by paying less tax and not buying that extra incubator. Local news last night, I think it was Swindon, they want 5 new incubators for their hospital for babies, because their current incubators are 15 years old, and they're going to try to buy them through a charity for the NHS, because you really should only have baby incubators if people feel like, you know, dipping into their own pocket, because it should be a personal decision, because a government doing this is terribly bad. That's who's ruling us. If any of you want to tell me I'm wrong, I'm happy to listen to you and not be too rude. But isn't it?
Okay, I'm afraid it's such a thought-provoking subject and something I'm sure we could hear so much more about. But for anyone who does have an event at 4, we have gone over a bit, so you might want to run off. So I thought better that we end it now, just in case. But thank you, Danny, for an amazing talk. Thank you so much.
Thank you.